off and on over the decades of the 20th century and into the 21st, interest has been spiked in extraterrestrial life, sometimes by UFO sightings and sometimes by solid scientific breakthroughs or discoveries at least. And we are going to look into the search for extraterrestrial life on University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland. My guest is Ed Churchwell. He's Professor Emeritus of Astronomy at the UW-Madison, and he has been looking, as have many of his fellow scientists. And welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
Where do you see it, historically speaking, Ed, as to where this search or even interest in extraterrestrial life begins?
Well, you know, I think, Norman, that humans have always been interested in the question of whether we're alone in the universe or not. But particularly, I think, began kind of in the first quarter of the last century, where we had some major telescopes come online and people were thinking about the whole issue. We know that there are hundreds of millions of stars in our galaxy, and surely some of those have planets around them, maybe all of them, and surely some of them are rather similar to the Earth. And so the whole question of whether there might be civilizations in space, more or less arose, I think, as a scientific question, in the early part of last century.
Has there been an ongoing listening for signals from space that might somehow be identified as coming from other civilizations?
Yeah, absolutely. The very first one I happen to know about, this was Frank Drake, who's a radio astronomer at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, I think in about 1962 or so, decided to point the 85-foot radio telescope at Green Bank, West Virginia, to a nearby star that looked rather similar to the sun and was not so far away that if they were playing their radios or whatever, or maybe even looking for us, he might be able to detect them. And he even derived an equation basically was the number of advanced civilizations in the galaxy, and it's known as the Frank Drake equation. It's a very famous equation. So the interest, I think, in terms of trying to actually detect civilizations that have the technical capability to communicate over interstellar distances, started in about 1962 with Frank Drake.
It's not likely with any kind of contemporary current technology, though, to lead to much of a conversation, isn't it? The Alpha Centauri is the closest star, and that's 4 light years away, and this
that's
would
right.
be farther
that,
than that.
But that's fairly close, actually, for interstellar conditions. And we now have telescopes that are doing incredible things. I mean, there's a satellite put up by NASA called the Kepler satellite, and it looked at a really tiny postage stamp piece of sky, and it just stared at that piece of sky for, I don't know, several years. And it detected over 3,000 stars that have planets orbiting around them. Now, the sad part of this story is that I happen to remember a professor who spent his entire career looking for stars that he could determine whether they actually had a planet orbiting around them, and he never succeeded. And it was kind of a sad story in many respects. And the very first planet that was ever detected around a star was a place that nobody would have ever even suspected. And this is a neutron star that actually has a planet orbiting around it. And that was a major surprise. It's still a surprise. We've never detected another planet around a neutron star or a black hole or any other thing like that. up until this time. But we've detected lots of planets around lots of stars in the last few years due to Kepler's observations, and now many other stars in addition to that. A lot of ground-based telescopes can now also have the capability to detect planets around other stars.
Well, the problem with a neutron star or a black hole would be, wouldn't it, that really wouldn't be conducive to sustaining life, or would it?
Well, it's the way these things are formed. A neutron star is basically formed by a very massive star exploding, and it would blow everything away, you would think. But nonetheless, there is a planet orbiting a neutron star.
And as far as detecting them, are you actually seeing these planets in some way, or is it a matter of sort of mathematically finding them based on the gravitational reactions of the stars?
It's mostly the latter. I mean, there are two ways, or several ways, but one way they observe is to look at a star and observe how bright it is. And if you have a planet orbiting around the star, and if the orbital plane is such that it actually the planet can orbit in front of the star will slightly dim while the planet is passing between us and it. And so you can see the planet, and then you can watch that and see if it's periodic or not. And that's a good example for one way to detect a planet. But we don't see the planet, you can't actually see a disk or anything like that. They're just too far away.
But it's the same phenomenon, I guess, as what we would have as a transit of Mercury or Venus.
Exactly, yeah.
Where we would actually see that disk crossing the face of the sun.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And so we have how many of these planets that have been discovered now?
Oh, my goodness, many. As I say, we've detected something like certainly over 3,000 stars. And many of them have multiple planets orbiting around them, just like our sun does. I know there's a system of several stars that have systems of 7 to 9 planets orbiting around them. So they have their own personalities, so to speak, each of these systems of planets.
But the planet would have to be, at least as far as sustaining life that we would know, and we're looking at that a little bit later, but it would have to be at a certain distance from the star based on the size and heat of the star.
Yeah, and it's a tricky thing to put too many constraints on this, because nature is so tricky in many ways. But yes, what one would really look for would be planets that are orbiting in what's called the habitable zone. And that habitable zone is determined by how hot the central star is, and therefore how massive it is. And the width of the zone is determined by also the temperature of the star. And for a very cool star, the habitable zone is actually quite close to the star and not very wide, the region in which you'd expect the life would have a chance, at least, of being able to survive on that planet.
The planet would have to be a certain size, wouldn't it, just in order to have enough gravitational pull to keep things on it?
There are a number of aspects about what the habitable zone means. I mean, you'd have to have a planet that's massive enough to, for example, to hold an atmosphere. It would have to be close enough that it would have liquid water on the surface. And you would also hope that the atmosphere it produces a climate that's stable. One that doesn't get too hot, too cold, too erratic, things like that. But there are also physical aspects about the planet that the planet has to be massive enough to hold its atmosphere. It also needs to be massive enough to have a central metallic core. that would produce, for example, volcanic activity. The Earth, for example, has a very carefully controlled mechanism for CO2, which, in fact, at the moment, we're overloading that natural process. It's called the CO2 cycle, but it involves plate tectonics on the surface and volcanism and so forth. So CO2 gets removed from the atmosphere by, for example, on the Earth, being absorbed into the ocean and going to the bottom and then being ground back into the mantle. And then the volcanic activity blows it back out into the atmosphere. And there are three ways to take CO2 out of our atmosphere. Earth is actually is amazing in many respects. You can take CO2 out by green plants, of course, that uses CO2 through and photosynthesis and gives out oxygen. But also, the ocean takes a lot of CO2 out, and the surface rocks also contains a lot of CO2. As a consequence, our atmosphere is pretty well controlled to keep the CO2 from becoming overloaded. But that doesn't happen in all planets, and Venus is a great example of that.
We'll get to Venus a little later in this conversation, yeah, when we get more into what exactly life is and how likely is it to exist on Earth. But in terms of these planets, sometimes they're called, what, Goldilocks planets?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
That have these ideal conditions so far as we know anyway. How many of these have we discovered out of those thousands of planets?
It's quite a few, actually. I'm just looking at, for the ones that have multiple planetary systems. The ones that we have been able to establish are in what's called the habitable zone, or the Goldilocks orbits, are not all that much. I don't know what the how the statistics are there. I've not kept up, you know, all that much lately, but there are several that we are pretty sure are in this habitable zone and have what we think are reasonable masses and so forth to protect themselves from the wind from their star and so forth, to hold on to their atmosphere, and have magnetic, global magnetic fields and so forth.
Are we able to study those planets more carefully to get any further ideas as to whether there's life on them?
Well, I don't think we're that far along yet. I mean, these days we're just happy to be able to try to determine how many stars have planetary systems, and how many planets there are in these systems and so forth. Basically, get into physical properties. As I say, this is a whole field that's really in its infancy, actually, in terms of, studying planets for the possibility of life. But the key thing always is, does it have the possibility to have liquid water on the surface? Because we're pretty sure that, although the whole question of the origin of life is a big one, and we don't really have an answer for that yet. I think there are lots of, a number of good theories and so forth based on scientific understanding of life on Earth, but we still have a long way to go, I would say.
So what do we do with that information about these planets that have these parameters that are favorable? What do we do with that if we can't really research further?
Well, one thing that we do try to do is to look at those planets. For example, if they pass between the star and our line of sight, we can try to determine if they have atmospheres or not. It's most amazing that, in fact, one can actually get a handle on whether a planet might have an atmosphere, because the light from the star passes around the edges of the planetary disk, and so you can take a spectra of the toward the planet, and determine whether there are spectral lines from oxygen, carbon, nitrogen, and so forth. If there's oxygen there, that's a very strong indication, because oxygen is not a thing that naturally would be abundant on a planet. That's something that's mainly produced by life.
So we've been listening for 60 years now for radio signals from anywhere that we might be able to pick them up. Has anything come out of that? What have we heard?
Well, there is the what's called the SETI project. Are you aware of the SETI project?
Mm-hmm.
Search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And that's a group that has done a lot of observational work to establish not only the planetary systems that exist that we have or close enough to us that we can study, but they also have been looked at the issues associated with what do you look for, what's the evidence,
right,
observational evidence, and so forth. As I say, one of the big ones, of course, is whether it has an oxygen-rich atmosphere, because that's something that, the Earth didn't start out with the atmosphere that we presently have. In fact, it didn't start out with any atmosphere to begin with.
Well, that's another factor, isn't it? Because the light that we're looking at least if we go out tonight and gaze into the sky, you might be seeing that star or galaxy as it was 100, 200 years ago.
Yeah, that's also true. The systems that we're studying now, though, that we have the ability to actually study in any detail, are not thousands of light years away. They're within a few 100 light years or so. That's already a very long distance. And so we have to stay pretty close to home in terms of our position in the galaxy to get any reasonable detailed information that would guide us in this whole question of the quest for life.
Well, let's look a little closer at what exactly life is when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Ed Churchwell, and we're talking about the search for extraterrestrial life. And we have determined that there are a number of planets out there beyond our solar system, well beyond, that, at least in theory, could support life. But let's look now at exactly what life is. I guess my first question, Ed, would be, how inevitable is it for life to have formed on Earth?
Oh, my goodness. That is the $64,000 question. There are two basic categories about the whole discussion of the origin of life. Origin of life is the single deepest question that I think we have not really been able to get a satisfactory answer to. There are basically two categories of theories. There's what's called the supernatural. Unfortunately, those are not testable and not necessarily repeatable. Creationism, for example, is one of those. So I'm going to just talk about the naturalistic origins of life. These are testable and within the realm of science. And there are three topics there. One, there's spontaneous generation, and that was one that was favored from Aristotle down to the Middle Ages.
And how did that work?
Well, it the origin of that is that if you, for example, let's say you put a piece of meat or whatever out and it starts to rot, and you put a a glass or something over it, and then a day or two later you open it up and flies, you know, insects fly out. And so it was thought that life had just spontaneously generated around this dead food. Of course, that held sway for several centuries, and it was only later when people started to realize that basically the possible have eggs laid in these in this meat, and you know they hatch out. So that was actually dropped. Over 100 years ago. The other idea is one called panspermia, and this is the idea that the Earth was actually, and other possibly other bodies in the solar system, basically had life brought to it through the asteroids that fall to the Earth.
Doesn't that beg the question, though?
It does, yes. It doesn't say anything about the origin. It just says possibly a way it came to Earth.
Right.
So the last one, and the one that is the scientifically viable one, in my opinion, is the chemical origin with evolution. Now, we have a good record of the past evolution of different life forms on the Earth. Fossils. That's the fossil record. We have a good fossil record of the evolution and change of different life forms over time. And we know that life started on the Earth almost 4 billion years ago, a few hundred million years after the Earth actually formed, at a time when it's amazing that the Earth was still being bombarded by the way that the planets actually grew from asteroids and so forth that had formed in the disk around the sun. So that is the whole concept of where life actually, how it actually begun. That's, I think, the deepest question and the most difficult question that we've been faced with. And we still don't, I would say, the actual details of how this happened, the warm little pond where enough atoms came together to form a long enough chains of amino acids and so forth to produce the first cell, that's still, I don't think we understand that. I certainly don't, and I'm not a biologist nor an expert, but I don't know. Don't know that I know a biologist who would tell you for sure and for certain that they know precisely how life actually got started.
But you're saying life appeared on Earth just within a few hundred million years after the creation
about a half
of the
million
Earth?
Years or so after the formation of the Earth, we have some record that there's already life had arisen.
What were the conditions, though, atmospheric conditions, temperature and that kind of thing that early on in the Earth's creation?
Well, it must have gotten to a stage where it was a reasonably stable atmosphere and reasonably oxygen-rich atmosphere.
And water?
And water, for sure. For example, the human body is about 65% oxygen. It's about over 18% carbon and almost 10% hydrogen and then nitrogen, and all the other stuff is tiny fractions. But the thing that makes you believe that this has been a natural process that could occur anywhere is the fact that these are the most abundant elements in the universe. And so we're made of the stuff that are universally most abundant. And the processes that could happen, one can visualize all right. The problem is, of course, proving it.
In the exact mechanism, I've seen it more than once and recently, too, in the topic of the creation of life or the evolution of life, a lightning bolt worked into the equation somewhere.
Yeah, that could very well be, the thing that kind of set this off was some experiments that was started by two biologists. Anyway, they had a vial with a fairly large tube with liquid water, and then with a mixture of what they thought at that time was the composition of the atmosphere in the early at the early Earth. They produced a lot of biological molecules out of it. So they thought they had actually discovered the origin of life. However, it turns out that what they thought the mixture of the atmospheric composition was at the time life appeared was not quite right. So they've tried it again with what is believed to be a better estimate of what the atmospheric composition was, and have not been able to reproduce all of those compounds. I think some compounds were produced that are important to life. But anyway, I would say that there's still a kind of a shadow over that whole question, at least in my mind, whether we know precisely if we could reproduce, life from the molecular structure and so forth.
But the most common elements in the human body, you say, are carbon, oxygen, and hydrogen.
Yeah, oxygen is the dominant one, and then carbon's the most abundant one for life. That is, I mean, we're made of 65% oxygen, and carbon's the next most abundant in our body. And hydrogen and nitrogen and so forth in smaller and smaller fractions.
And those are the most common elements in the universe?
They're the most abundant, among the most abundant. Hydrogen and helium, of course, are by far the most abundant. But hydrogen doesn't weigh anything, so in terms of mass, it's only about 10% of our body.
And so by extension, we're saying, well, if we are made of the most abundant atoms, elements in the universe, by extension, we're saying it's most likely that anything else out there that would be a life form would be made of those same elements.
That's exactly the point. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
And so that helps to guide our search for life elsewhere. But what do we know then? Once we'll kind of just take it for granted that, yes, life somehow developed from very small, even molecules or cells. Once we just accept that without knowing exactly how it happened, what else then do we know about the evolution of life on Earth that would help us to determine whether it's out there in extraterrestrial places?
Well, by far and away, the most important issue beyond that is a question of whether there's liquid water on the surface. You need water to be able to move these molecules around, to get them to connect and so forth. And if we're the only kind of life in the universe, namely based on the molecular structure of life, then we've got to have water. And that's exactly what's guided NASA and most of its missions. The whole issue of Mars, for example, is water. Mars is a dry planet now, but there's lots of evidence that Mars had life in the, in the past, had water in the past anyway, and there's likelihood that we might have see evidence for that past life now. And so that's the driver for at least NASA's missions to Mars.
And in these extraterrestrial planets outside the solar system, do we have a way of determining if there's water there?
No, not easily. If we are able to determine the mass, then we have some idea of whether it might be massive enough to hold an atmosphere. Well, we can also see evidence for the atmosphere through spectroscopy, but whether there's water on the surface of those planets, even if they're in the habitable zone, is a difficult question. And I don't think we know really how to get a handle on that.
So we're going to be looking closer to home then.
I think that's right. I mean, we still have to search our own solar system much more carefully and deeply before I think we make the step, out to other planetary systems. We can see whether the various stars have planets within this habitable zone, so-called, but it doesn't necessarily say there's going to be life there.
Before we get to our own solar system, about the type of stars that are suitable for the suggestion of life, does that make any difference? Yellow dwarf, red giant, any difference there?
It probably does. You need a certain amount of, for example, ultraviolet light. But if you have too much ultraviolet light, it's also destructive. The amount of ultraviolet radiation that a star produces depends on its temperature and therefore the kind of star and the mass of the star. And so, yes, I think you look for stars that are kind of like the sun, some that might be a little bit hotter and some that might even be a little bit cooler to produce the spectrum that could be the one that would not be too much ultraviolet radiation, but just enough to get light, to support the kind of molecular reactions that we would need.
So it doesn't help if you're just farther away from a star that generates more UV?
Well, it would help in terms of the habitable zone is different for between every star. The hotter the star, the further out the habitable zone is. And so that tells you something about the kind of temperature that the planet might have. But the temperature of the star itself just says something about the fraction of the kind of radiation that you would like to have to produce life. But I don't think it's not a hard and fast rule. Nature is much more inventive than we think it is.
It's so true. Is there anything that would say that a star could have more than one habitable planet in its solar system?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think there's one system that we know of that I think has at least two stars or two planets in the habitable zone for that star. So, yeah, no, it can have more. The habitable zone also changes with time because the stars age and burn their their nuclear fuel. They burn hotter and hotter and produce more and more energy. And so the habitable zone actually slowly moves outward from the star. And so it's not fixed even for a given star. But it's a very slowly moving thing. That's the other thing.
Moving out of the habitable zone makes me wonder why this sudden renewed interest in Mars. But
well, Mars is slightly outside
for now.
For now. At some time in the future, it will probably move into it. But I don't think Mars will ever have a chance for life on it in any natural process.
Well, let's look more closely at the possibility of life in our solar system when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Ed Churchwell, and we're talking about the search for extraterrestrial life. And we've determined there are a lot of planets beyond our solar system that have the right properties that are conducive to the development of life, although they're a little too far away for us to get into the specifics. But now we're going to look closer to home. And this is the point where I'd be tempted to hear an excerpt from War of the Worlds, maybe, you know, and I wouldn't say credible, but more credible possibilities of interacting with those extraterrestrial life forms. So there are, I guess, two main candidates to look at first, and I guess we'll take them from their distance to the sun. So Venus. Venus is notoriously inhospitable, isn't it? But it does have an atmosphere.
It has an atmosphere. It's almost 100 times the amount of atmosphere that the Earth has. It's on the Earth, the atmospheric pressure is like about 1 bar, or about 15 pounds per square inch. On Venus, it's 90 bars. It's almost 100 times. It's a hellish place. It's a planet that has gone completely wild. It's lost its atmosphere is almost all carbon dioxide. I'm sorry, CO2, and it has had a runaway greenhouse effect. At the beginning, we're pretty sure that Venus and Earth were very similar. They're about the similar mass and size. Venus is just about 30% closer to the sun than the Earth. But that 30% has made a certain amount of difference. What has happened on Venus is that it has no first, let me just talk about the properties of the planet. As I say, it has this massive atmosphere. It's almost all CO2. The surface temperature on this planet is 870 degrees Fahrenheit. That's enough to melt lead. And of course, if the pressure doesn't kill you, the temperature will. And the Russians were the first ones to put a probe on the surface of Venus, and its probe lasted for less than a half an hour, I think. It just got burned to a crisp.
What was that probe made out of? Something better than lead?
Well, it was able to survive, I think, just because it was encased in a shell of some sort. But I don't think they were expecting the temperature to be what it was. And so, as I say, this is a hellish planet. And the reason we now know, as I say, I think at the beginning, Venus and the Earth must have been very similar. They were made out of the same stuff in the same process as, the assemblage of asteroids in the solar disk. They had the same amount of composition. And as I say, they're about the same size. So how did they get so different?
Right.
Well, Venus, the big difference here is Venus has no surface water. And the Earth has got 70% of its surface is water, it's oceans.
Wouldn't all the water on Venus, if it had any, have long since boiled away, though?
Yeah, the question is, did it ever have any? Because the oxygen on Venus got more or less broken up by the solar radiation. I mean, wants to produce water, the oxygen and hydrogen get separated. Even so, if there's no ocean surface there, there's no sink for CO2 that way, and there's no forest there, so there's no sink that way. The only sink for CO2 in Venus is in the carbonate rocks that are on the surface. But the Earth has three different sinks. It's got the ocean, it's got green forest and green vegetation, and it does have surface rocks. And so once you close off this, what's called the CO2 cycle, there's no way to get the CO2 out of the atmosphere. It turns out that Venus and Earth have about the same amount of CO2. The difference is that all of it's in the atmosphere in Venus, and in the Earth, it's a small fraction of the amount of CO2 that that's available to the Earth. And the only thing that we need to worry about is overloading this CO2 cycle, such that we're pumping more CO2 into the atmosphere at a rate that the natural processes normally take it out. And at the moment, we're pressing that, of course.
And that's how you get a greenhouse effect.
That's how you get a greenhouse effect. And Venus is a great example of a runaway greenhouse effect.
Well, I can see a great, I'm sure it's probably been done 50 times already, but a great bit of science fiction speculating that at some, at least, point in its evolution, Venus was more Earth-like, but the foolish inhabitants pumped too much CO2 into the atmosphere and it went greenhouse.
Yeah, that's possible. It's not clear to me that Venus ever really had possibility for oceans, but that's a step beyond where we are at the moment. But we do know that Venus, from its average density and so forth, is very similar to the Earth in almost all respects. Both planets have nuclear central region that's a molten, very hot core, but Venus has already pumped most of its CO2 into the atmosphere.
And Venus, though, so 800 and some odd degrees on the surface.
Yeah.
Haven't there been found microorganisms on Earth that live in hotter conditions than that?
No, nothing like that.
They live in volcanoes, but not that hot.
Yeah, they're what's called extremophiles that are, for example, around black smokers at the bottom of the sea and so forth. But these are, the temperatures around those are not nearly like 800 degrees. It's hotter than the life that than we would be able to survive in. But yeah, there's a third area of life. There's prokaryotes, eukaryotes, and there's archaea. And the these are the what's called life forms that are basically depend on archaea. Most primitive life forms.
So it's not looking too good for Venus for life forms.
Nope. No, I don't think Venus will ever have a chance to have life.
All right. Let's go to Mars.
Okay, yes. Mars is a good question. It's a very small planet. It's only a tenth the mass of the Earth. And so it's surprising to me that actually it's able to hold on to an atmosphere at all. There's very clear that it has had in the past liquid water present, and now the planet is both cool and dry. It's a cool desert surface on that planet. But the atmosphere, again, is all CO2. But it's a very, very thin atmosphere. And, for example, that's why when they landed on Mars, they used this parachute. They put the parachute, started out very early, and a very large parachute, because the atmosphere is hardly enough to really slow it down, slow the lander down very well. What happened to the ocean that was on Mars? Again, this has to do, I think, with the fact that it's a small planet, and it has no liquid core to produce a magnetic field, a global magnetic field. And so we think that a lot of Mars's early atmosphere basically got blown away by the wind from the sun. The sun has high velocity particles that are blown out, and they can actually disrupt our communications and so forth when these magnetic storms occur on the sun. And these particles are moving at like 600 kilometers a second or more. They're really blowing by, and they can actually blow the atmosphere of a planet away. And since Mars has this small mass, Its atmosphere is probably early atmosphere is probably mostly blown away.
So are we thinking that its atmosphere is going to continue to blow away?
Probably. I mean, it's a slow process, I think, but that's probably part of the issue. And there's probably other meteorological conditions as well, but that's one idea of why why Mars has lost some of its atmosphere, particularly the water. The water, as I say, is probably broken down by solar radiation.
So the price of real estate is going down as we speak.
Yeah,
but
to hold an atmosphere, a planet has to have a certain minimum gravitational force to do that. And Mars is right on the edge of being able to do that.
Any sense that there's water under the surface of Mars?
Yes, that's the real hope here, is that although there's the planet itself is very dry, the fact that it had clearly had water and great abundance in the past, vapor pressure is not enough to hold that water, and it's evaporated and, as I say, blown away. But so the hope is that there might be microbes that could even still be alive on that planet under the surface, if there's enough water there to support it. But even if there isn't current life there at the moment, we might find evidence for not life in the past. And the reason it's so critical to try to search for life is basically to establish that life is universal. That is, it's molecular in nature, and it's basically based on carbon. The backbone of life is carbon, because carbon produces very strong bonds that allows molecules to build up in long, very long chains to make the molecules of life.
What would we find on Mars that would indicate that there is or has been life?
Well, if we find evidence, for example, for protein or lipids or carbohydrates, or even amazingly nucleic acids, all those would say life. It would do two things. It would say that give some idea that life is universal, and that we basically understand, its life processes and so forth, and even ultimately how life really originated.
Is it likely to require putting a person on Mars in order to get that fine a detail in our discoveries there?
I think you could bring back samples probably do the job as well. But if you wanted to put a person on there, the important thing is to make sure that he has plenty of potatoes.
Now explain that. It sounds familiar, but...
well, the movie, The Martian, I don't know whether you've
seen that movie. Right. Was it Matt Damon? Yeah.
Yeah, he basically plants potatoes. He got stranded on Mars and planted potatoes inside his controlled house that he lived in, and survived there for almost a year with potatoes.
It was very convincing to me, the science, definitely cutting edge, though, and a certain amount of imagination required, too.
It's clear that life is very, it's very, once it is established, it's tenacious. There's not almost any place on the face of the earth you could take a handful of Earth and find evidence for life. It's everywhere. The Earth has the most incredibly good conditions for life, of any other place in this solar system. There's actually a book called Rare Earth, and it argues that the Earth is basically has so much life on it because of a number of very lucky circumstances. Its atmosphere, its composition, the atmosphere, its surface water, and so forth, all the stuff that you need to support life. It's more than just at any given instant in time. It has to be circumstances that have been kind of constant over, long periods of time.
Sure, in order to evolve, especially into higher life forms, I would think.
Right, right.
There has been some talk about Titan, the moon of Saturn, as having at least evidence of some water in some form?
Well, not water. Titan is a really strange moon of Jupiter. It's about one and a half times the night diameter of Earth's moon, but it's very, very cold there. Its atmosphere is 95% nitrogen and methane. Its surface, we now know because of Cassini, is hydrocarbon lakes, ethane and methane lakes. The temperature there is like 290 degrees Fahrenheit. Titan is an interesting from the point of view of the fact that it does have this dense atmosphere of these hydrocarbons. And so you wouldn't have any problem with fuel there. But the other places in the solar system that are more likely to have possibility for life is Europa and possibly Callisto and Ganymede. These are moons around Jupiter. The reason I say that is that it looks like these moons have a very thick crust of ice around them. You can see the cracks and so forth from the photographs of the surface. And it looks like these cracks have been filled up with fluid welling up from underneath when they have these cracks. They hold the possibility of having a fluid ocean underneath these ice crusts. There's still enough heat from within, having to do with actually an interesting process of tidal motions of these planets. As they in their orbit around Jupiter, they also there's a resonance between Jupiter's rotation period and orbital periods of Ganymede and Europa and so forth. This grinding of the planet produces heat, and so it's enough tidal motions to basically heat the water if there's water there. And it looks like from the mean densities that there is lots of water, possibly oceans underneath on both Europa and possibly Ganymede. So that's a case where this whole idea of the habitable zone may need to be redefined because there are possibilities of life way outside the habitable zone on Earth. But it's, let's say, this is supposition. We have no idea whether life is actually developed under these circumstances. Because they would not get any direct sunlight. And even if they did, the amount of sunlight that you get at the distance of Jupiter is about 1/25 per square surface area. It's about 1/25 of what the Earth gets. So they're very cold places, but we can't rule it out.
Well, it's going to be fascinating to see what else contemporary and future technology discover about these places in our solar system in particular and the possibility of life there. Ed Churchwell, it's been a pleasure getting filled in about this possibility of extraterrestrial life.
It's been my pleasure, Norman.
And thank you for that. And I hope that you can join me next time around for University of the Air.